Chapter 13, Five Flights a Day. While my dream had always been to move to America, I don't think it was ever my father's dream to leave his beloved Gibraltar Lane home. Oh, sure, it was okay to visit America once in a while, but he always wanted to return to Jamaica. That was home. He was comfortable with his circle of friends and his job as an electrician at motor sales. He was happy doing his little hustle after work, as he called it, fixing cars for other people in the concreted garage adjoining the house. But politics in Jamaica started to change in the 1970s. Michael Manley from the PNP party became prime minister in 1972. By 1974, not only were we dealing with the oil crisis, but with increased violence and food shortages in the country. There were shortages of rice, detergent, salt, cornmeal, cooking oil, and of all things, sugar, which I could never understand, as we lived in a country that produced massive amounts of sugarcane. The only way you could get this food, a lot of times, was if friends or family packed it in a barrel and sent it from America. If a store did get a small shipment in of detergent, for example, crowds of people would line up outside the supermarket. There was lots of shoving in the line, and it got ugly at times. When you did find the desired food, you might have to buy something else that you really didn't want, like sardines or corned beef, to get the detergent or a pound of sugar. And you better believe you paid exorbitant prices. This practice was called marrying the food. This was the store's way of taking advantage of the food shortage and doubling their profit. Great political discussions were held on a regular basis on the Gibraltar Lane veranda, amidst the clinking of glasses of white rum and bottles of Red Stripe beer. My father and his friends would passionately debate Michael Manley's push for socialism, his relationship with Fidel Castro of Cuba, and spend hours pontificating on how they could fix the country. It was like a CNN political talk show. "Why you think he's so friendly with Castro and the Russians? Him is a communist man. I tell you, the Americans don't like it at all. You don't see them all leaving Jamaica." "And what Castro can do for Manley? You don't see fiend people are dead for hungry." "Him want to take from the rich and give to the poor. But the rich are leaving and we can't get food to eat." "Look, all I know is, if one man can do the job, put another one in. I have never seen Jamaica this bad and in this condition." There were strikes, factories closing down, and power cuts. I think the last straw for Daddy was when Manley was re-elected for another four-year term in 1976 and threatened to take over privately owned businesses. There was a mass exodus of the middle and upper class. When he started saying negative things about America, the Americans and Canadians left and took their money and businesses with them. When Jamaicans started to complain, Manley's famous saying was, "Five flights a day to Miami. If you don't like it, you can leave." Well, that struck fear and anger in the hearts of many Jamaicans, and many took him up on that offer. My father was one of them. He had had enough. Luckily for us, since my mother had been working in America, she had filed for permanent residency for us, and the green cards for Daddy, Susie, and me had just come through. My youngest sister, Deidre, had already been living in America since she was 5 months old. So in 1976, we left Jamaica and our comfort zone to start over in a new culture, in a new country. We left our home behind, as Grandma Vida would stay there, and whatever property we owned, and most of our money in the bank. You see, because the mass exodus was removing money from Jamaican banks, and they were on the brink of collapse, we could only take $200 per person to start over in a new country. I think Daddy took it the hardest. He had left what he had worked so hard for to start over in a culture with a whole new set of rules. "Why," he said, "they don't even drive on the right side of the road." We rented part of a house from a family friend in Miami, and Mommy enrolled me and Susie in school. To me, it was exciting. It was what I always wanted. I was in the 11th grade at Norland High School. No more ugly school uniforms. However, I found out that I was not widely accepted among the African Americans. They didn't like my lighter skin and called me red. They made fun of my accent, and because I was shy at first, they said I was stuck up. I was introduced to racial prejudice. I did not know of this in Jamaica, as we were proud to be a mixed culture from a country where the motto was, out of many, one people. But I eventually made three friends, all of whom just happened to have some of Jamaican heritage. I worked hard on losing my Jamaican accent so I could assimilate into the culture. I had a hunchback, wore glasses, and was definitely not a popular girl. I took medical PE because my asthma was so bad, I couldn't take regular PE. So, I studied about sports from a book. My favorite was American football, in which they hardly ever kick the ball. So, why was it called football again? They called Jamaican football soccer, and they had never even heard of cricket. I even worked as a reporter on the school newspaper. Yes, I was a nerd. I didn't go to prom, never got invited, and it might have been too much money for my family back then. Susie took it hard. She was not impressed with our rental house and missed our big tree-filled Gibraltar Lane property that she could run around it on. She was only 8 years old. She was not happy with learning a new system. The letter Z was pronounced Z in Jamaica, so she was always being corrected. She told the teacher, "That's how we say it in Jamaica." "Well, you're in America now," the teacher replied. She got words like neighbor and labor wrong on spelling tests because the British system had an O-U-R instead of just O-R at the end. She thought the kids were meaner, but she had left all her friends in Jamaica. People were not quite so friendly here, so for a while, she became quiet and antisocial, especially after she got beaten up by a huge boy on her way home from school. Eventually, she made some friends and grew tougher skin. My parents had a close-knit group of Jamaican friends, cooked Jamaican food, and even found Jamaican radio stations. We even found a Baptist church that had a few Jamaican members. Most Jamaicans we knew saved up all year to go home, either for Jamaican Independence Day in August or for Christmas. They would pack a barrel or two and send it on ahead. In the beginning, we barely went home to Jamaica. We were saving up for a home of our own, and in 1977, we moved into our first home in Miami. Daddy quickly laid concrete on a large portion of the front and backyard and bought himself a shed so he could work on cars. His landscaping was a little tree he planted smack dab in the little piece of grass he left in the front yard. In the backyard, he planted every Jamaican plant that he could find. Some had been sneaked through customs. We had coconut trees, banana trees, orange and grapefruit. He even planted mango. Wrought iron burglar bars went up on the windows, and he started working on cars in his spare time again. His day job was at Kelly Tractor Company. He made some Jamaican friends. I felt like life was finally normalizing for him. And Mommy, she was already assimilated, and just a trooper. She worked and went to school. She went from cleaning houses to school, to become a phlebotomist, and working in a hospital, taking blood from patients, and then went back to school to become a medical technologist. She eventually learned how to drive and got her own car. Her drive to succeed was an inspiration to me. You see, I had dreams too. I wanted to be a doctor, and America offered me the perfect opportunity. And while my parents sought comfort in holding on to their Jamaican friends, Jamaican food, and all the Jamaican culture they could find in America, I sought full assimilation. They clung so tightly to Jamaican values that sometimes it felt like we had never left. I often felt a pang of regret if someone would say, "Remember Gibraltar, Lane?" It would flood our memories and often bring smiles to our faces. It made us long for what we left behind on a dusty gravel road in Kingston, Jamaica. Our life on Gibraltar Lane. Gibraltar Lane, A Jamaican Odyssey, was written, performed, and produced by Marcy Malcolm, based on the life and times of my childhood in Jamaica. Music and editing by Charles Malcolm, with special thanks to Christopher Malcolm. I would like to take this time to personally thank you for joining me on this journey. I cannot express the gratitude for every listener who took the time to hear this story. And I have many more to tell. I hope you'll get to hear them one day. But until then, me gone. Walk good.